A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is How to Win an Election. I'm Matt Chorley, and you can come and see us recording an episode of the podcast live the morning after the local elections, Friday, May the 3rd, at Times Radio Towers in London Bridge. If you're a Times subscriber, just go to mytimesplus.co.uk for all the details and hope to see you there. Now on with this week's episode. I agree with podcasts. Strike up the band!
You don't really want it to explode under the country.
The 1990s neoliberal tribute act.
Buffing up our interview suits. Do you remember?
No,
Fitz?
We're not talking about testicles again.
Yeah, here we are again then. It's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, joined as ever by new Labour mastermind Peter Mamson. Polly McKenzie is Policy McKenzie, former director of policy for Nick Clegg, and Tory brainbox Danny Finkelstein. If you want to get in touch and send us your questions, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk or WhatsApp 0333 003 2353, like so many of you have done for this week's special questions episode. Are we all well?
Very well. We've had a lovely weekend.
Good, good. Happy Easter and all of that.
Yeah, and I've got you each an egg.
Have you?
Left over from the Easter festivities. Oh. Here you are, there, Danny.
Look at this.
See you.
Oh, you should have the Lib Dem orange one, Polly.
Oh, yes, and you can have the, mauve one. It matches your jacket.
The UKIP one.
Well, I'll have the UKIP one.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, thank you for that.
That's all right.
Is it ethically sourced?
Of course. Fair trade.
It was made from the cocoa chocolate stamp. He grows on his own grounds in Wiltshire. Is there a little treat inside? Oh, no, it's empty. All that promise. All that it was all glitzy on the outside.
It's a new Labour.
I was waiting for that.
Can I just say, this is really low-quality chocolate. You did not splash out. This is... like.
I'm afraid it was the leftovers from the children.
I'm not impressed.
Danny's not even touched it.
No, I'm keeping it for later.
Low cocoa content.
Well, you can be disappointed in your own time. Lovely.
Well, basically, it's my ridiculous diet.
Thank you for your gratitude.
Thank you, Peter. That was lovely. You were saying you've met another fan.
Yeah, I met another fan. I was wandering along the through Regent's Park looking for a taxi, and suddenly I was startled out of my wits by a cyclist racing down who said, "Great, Peter, love the podcast."
Wow.
And off he went.
And was it somebody who worked for Keir Starmer?
No, I think the Keir Starmer people are not as enthusiastic about the podcast as perhaps the cyclists in Regent's Park are.
Very good. Well, that's part of that. But they don't need to know how to win an election, so there's no need for them to listen.
Anyway, thank you very much to the cyclists if you're listening.
Yeah, good. Do get in touch in all the usual ways, as Rowan has done. This is another first for the podcast. We've had people playing the theme on their heads and on various musical instruments. This is the first How to Win an Election poem.
Hi Matt, it's Rowan here. I've written you a poem. Strike up the band, cries Times Radio's Matt, the hardest working political podcaster who even fasted like Sunak. Peter's seen it from every side, even coaxed back with yoghurt by Gordon. And as Lord President of the Council, he could have carried the sword, not Penny Mordaunt. For Danny, he has yet to be persuaded that much will move the dial. Ding, 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 goes Matt's bell. But it's based on facts, Danny says with a smile. Here's Polly McKenzie, the artist formerly known as Nick Clegg's Brain, which must have looked weird on LinkedIn, but better than some of Peter's nicknames. We get the inside scoop on PMs. Polly was lent a towel by Theresa May. who had told Danny no early election, and then ruined Matt's holiday. The flat-pack furniture bromance didn't happen. Nick Clegg wasn't even his friend, and Dave wouldn't have shown it to Danny if half of it was made by Lib Dems. So come and listen to the podcast, and be fair to Ed Miliband. This is How to Win an Election. Strike up the band!
Oh, oh very good.
I thought at first it was going to rhyme, and I was thinking, God, that's not...
No, it's a very modern sort of poem.
But actually, I think it was much better for the fact that it didn't.
There was a light rhyme.
I thought it was... Yeah, no, there was. Yeah, yeah. I thought it was very accomplished. And also, incredible attention to detail.
Yeah, there's bits I'd forgotten.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Really, really good that was.
I would love to have carried Penny Modern Sword.
Would you?
Oh, God, yes.
Did you know that was part of the job?
No, I didn't realise. We weren't actually... I wasn't thinking of, you know, coronations.
No.
But, oh, dear. No, the only time I ever did anything like that was during the state opening of Parliament. Yeah. But I had no sword to carry.
Did you not think of crowning Tony, you know?
Many a time. He was sort of self-crowning, wasn't he?
But no one
carried... Like a self-basting chicken.
Thank you, Matt.
What did you think of the poem, Polly?
Maybe the scanning... the rhythm was a little unconventional. It wasn't quite Julia Donaldson.
No.
I'll say that. But... the attention to detail, genuinely, I'd blocked some of that out, let alone forgotten.
Yeah. Well, thank you to Rowan. Rowan, thank you for sending that in.
Yeah, well done.
If you want to send us a poem, please do. We'll enjoy it, even if Polly doesn't. 0333 003 2353 if you want to record it, send it. Let's turn our attention now to an email from Stefan. Now, because we're in the middle of recess, for some reason, they're having the best part of 3 weeks off, so there's no PMQs, but Stefan got in touch to say, I've recently discovered this podcast. I'm still catching up with all the episodes. I love the fact people have gone back to the beginning, like they're, you know, it's Friends or Breaking Bad or something. Let me just say that I enjoy it very much, and it's great to witness that reasonable political discussion between members of different parties is still possible in these very politically divided times. On the issue of civility in political discourse, my question is, what purpose does the weekly shouting match known as PMQs actually serve? Most questions are, in my opinion, either a blame game between parties or to underline the respective MP's own party's glory. Few questions are actual concerns raised by the MP's constituents. I'm not a voter in the UK, but if I were, I think I wouldn't be swayed by any party watching what is going on there. Please explain. Thanks and greetings from Germany, Stefan. Polly, what's the point of PMQs?
Well, I mean, it does play an important role, I think, in just simply forcing a Prime Minister to come to Parliament and answer questions, to be on top of their brief, to know what's going on. And you know, there aren't many other countries that have quite that much sort of forensic structured scrutiny of a Prime Minister or a President. I think that is valuable. My personal experience of it is pretty limited. I mean, I used to be part of the team that briefed Nick Clegg for PMQs when he had two questions. So this is in the run-up to 2010.
When he was asking questions.
Yeah. And it was... I did go into the chamber once, and it is absolutely horrific. Like, a viscerally unpleasant experience. The way the braying and the noise and the toxic, horrible energy of it, which you don't experience, I think, if you watch it. If you watch it on TV, it's like, oh, wow, there's horrible people shouting at each other. You go into the room, it is certainly, for me, a genuinely painful experience.
Were you in the downstairs bit?
Yeah, there's like a little sort of side box for observers. I swore never to go in again.
Yeah. I've done a lot of Prime Minister's questions preparation, and I it's not my form of discourse, but I found myself embarrassingly having a facility for helping people to produce these kind of jobs.
He was good at it.
Yeah. but I realised there is actually a hidden importance, which is because the Prime Minister can be asked a question about anything, they have to be on top of everything, as Polly pointed out, but it means they police Whitehall, all of the departments. So what happens a lot of time is somebody suggests, you know, the Leader of the Opposition or the Prime Minister may ask may say this. You know, these representatives may ask the Prime Minister this question. What are you going to answer? The Prime Minister then assesses what they're being provided by a department as an answer and says, that's not an answer. I can't say that. Go back and tell them to find me a better answer, or ask them about... So they Theresa May certainly, and I think this was true of David Cameron, would tell you the same, used Prime Minister's questions to ensure that she was across all the departments and sometimes would call a minister in to help prepare a question which she thought was obvious. With Jeremy Corbyn, it was a bit difficult, by the way, because with other people, you could tell what they were going to ask, whereas Jeremy Corbyn could literally ask anything. And he usually, a bit like the two Ronnies, he would ask the question he should have asked the previous week. it was that made it harder to prepare, actually, the response. Unfortunately, it does reward. So the unfortunate thing is it does reward, you know, the ability to have a well-turned joke, which usually involves anticipating what's going to come in one direction. So you know what spontaneous quip to put back in the other direction. And if you're good enough at it with the quip and the anticipation, you can make it really work. And that does matter. But the good side of it is, as you'd expect me to say, you can be very successful at PMQs and it doesn't really move the dial, as it didn't with William Hague. He was superb at it. But I think that did miss a point, which was Tony Blair was superb at it too, and he was very good at the answers. I would argue it is important with your members. So William Hague would tell you he felt that at times when there was literally nothing else going for him, it was the one thing that rallied his own side. Much as I've always argued people should sit quietly while other people are saying things in the chamber, that's my view, because that's how you engage in a proper discourse and a discussion. Truthfully, we're not going to have that, and therefore this kind of the toxic thing that you talk about, Polly, that's...
But it's interesting the point you make about William Hague. People say, oh, he was very good at it, but he didn't win the election. But it could have actually been worse for him if he'd also, on top of everything else, been bad at PMQs.
There are some things that don't move the dial in terms of winning the election, but nevertheless keep you in office. So I remember once Dominic Cummings has this sort of view, you know, he understood how little actually moved the dial electorally. And certainly he thought that whether he had good relations or not with the Prime Minister's wife was one of those things that the press was obsessed with, but didn't matter at all. And yet there he was on the steps of Downing Street with a cardboard box that was the product of his argument with the Prime Minister's wife. So he certainly discovered it did matter in that sense, that what goes on in Westminster and who goes up and down in politics and whether you're strong with the parties, that can be affected by things like Prime Minister's questions or rows with the Prime Minister's wife.
Yeah, PMQs is much more about Westminster and inside the Beltway in the bubble than it is for the general public in the country. Having said that, Danny mentions Tony Blair. I remember the first PMQs that Blair did after the 1997 election. First thing he did, by the way, was to change the entire format. It had been 15 minutes twice a week on Tuesday and Thursday, going on for eons. Can you imagine the amount of prime ministerial time that was taken for 2 days of a five-day week in which he had to prepare for absolutely anything that might be asked about any aspect of government business and be knowledgeable about it. So he said, no, come on, let's do it half an hour on one day. That's a better use of the Prime Minister's time. He comes to the dispatch box, puts aside his vast ring binder folder and never picks it up. He stands at the dispatch box and for half an hour, I always remember it, it was incredibly civilised. The sheer range of questions that he was asked from all parts of the House was extraordinary, and he just delivered this fluent, impeccable, lots of facts, lots of argument, and it really did set a very, very important tone for him and for the government. And I think that what William Hague was doing in the end was sort of bouncing off Blair the whole time. I think you say William was very good, and he was. He was very sharp and he was very funny, but he bounced off Blair, quite honestly.
By the end. I mean, interestingly, I feel there was a documentary made about William Hague, and part of it included some of William Hague's prep for Prime Minister's questions, and it was a bit of a mistake, because after that, I think Tony Blair kind of got more of the measure of it. He was exceptional, and basically William did very well within the constraints of the fact that Tony Blair is an exceptional political talent, actually, and he was really, really good. Can I just say on the question of detail that he was across, you know, that was one of the things that really impressed me about Theresa May, who has other things which you may say that's not a great political skill, but in terms of her ability to come to accumulate information and to be able to deploy it, that was completely brilliant. And Boris Johnson didn't spend any time on Prime Minister's questions. I think he did 1 hour on Wednesday mornings, didn't really acquaint himself with the files. People often accused him of lying, but actually I noticed when they did, it was usually because he'd used a figure that was by this point out of date. It was mainly because he didn't know. I mean, imagine doing Prime Minister's questions on all these things if you don't know the answer. But it would be a horrendous experience. So he probably just winged it.
It wasn't a figure that brought him down. I mean, famously, I've just said, I think, you know, PMQs are for the bubble and they don't have any impact on the general public. Well, the lie to that is what happened to Boris Johnson. PMQs brought Boris Johnson down. It finished his prime ministerial career because he didn't tell the truth.
He said there were no parties.
He didn't tell the truth.
I agree that wasn't about a figure.
At a time when people were really focused on COVID, not least because so many of us were sort of just at home looking for something to watch on the TV, you know, people became more attuned to PMQs. They followed it more for that period of time, less so now, I suspect. And Boris Johnson came to the dispatch box and he didn't tell the truth. Had he done the opposite, had he come and said, look, make a clean breast of it, it's an awful mistake, we should never have done this, everything got completely out of control, we weren't thinking straight, and I apologise profusely, he would have survived.
I don't think he would have done.
I think he would have survived.
But PMQs fundamentally rewards discipline and breadth and understanding. And
opposite of Boris Johnson.
Exactly. You know, the fundamental problem with Boris Johnson, which is it's just sort of visible through PMQs, but it was not just limited to that, is that he didn't take the job seriously. He thought of the job as performance, as storytelling and bombast. And there is a part of the role of a prime minister or a mayor, which absolutely is just being a figurehead. But it's also a job which requires seriousness and discipline. And he never brought any of that.
So PMQs found him out.
He was, let's be clear, he was politically a very, very talented person, Boris Johnson, but just not at this. And you know, you're right, it didn't suit him. And actually, this is interesting, this discussion, because what's illustrating is that there's certain things that are involved in prime minister's questions, which are the essence of being prime minister, being across the job, being across the detail. And prime minister's questions, despite all the points that Stefan makes, despite all the stuff that you say about the toxic atmosphere, it is somehow, I think we're almost establishing it through this chat, it is somehow bringing out something essentially prime ministerial, which means that if you're not serious about the job, you can't do that bit.
And so often as well, when you sort of look back and think, the number of times when I was reporting in the gallery, you'd go in and think, this is a terrible moment, whether it's Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or David Cameron, there's no way they can get out of this moment, that the opposition is going to kick them out of the park. And actually the ability to respond to those questions and then emerge from it, David Cameron in particular, I remember probably most, you'd go in and think, there's no way he's going to get around the fact that, I don't know, Ian Duncan Smith has resigned, there's rebellion on this and there's that scandal and whatever. And somehow through the skill of being on the
tap danced. He tap danced his way through.
But that's a great skill. Yeah, it's a great skill. And so, you know, and it's a real, it also helped, I think, that particular time. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn remembered to ask about Ian Duncan Smith, which slightly helped the fact that the Working Pension Secretary had resigned over cuts to welfare. He forgot to bring it up.
I remember Blair's last BMQs when, I'm pretty sure Ricky Younger-Ross, the MP for
Teignmouth in Lib Dem in the West Country. That's why Polly was looking at me.
Yeah, exactly. You know everything about the West Country. He asked a question which was, I think, something to do with faith schools or the role of religion in society, and Blair just sighed and said, "I can't be bothered," and sat down. And it was that was
really?
A moment. Yeah, it was.
I think he might have said something like, "I think I'll leave that one," or something. But he basically just
Leave that one to my successor.
It was a glorious moment of real statesmanship.
And then he closed the book and said, "That's it. Goodbye."
Yeah.
And he got an ovation.
An ovation. he was the future once and all of that. Right, up next, we're going to talk about does going negative work, negative campaigning, does that work? And what difference will newspaper endorsements make in an election in 2024? Do that next on How to Win an Election.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, this is How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, still joined by Peter Manderson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. We are doing your questions as a special this week. So this one has come in from Joe. She says, hi, I really enjoy the How to Win podcast. I think of it as the cozy crime of politics podcasts.
Crime?
I don't know what that means.
What it means,
a brand of politics.
Yes,
it's a brand of podcast.
No, it's a brand of TV program and okay.
With the Midsummer Bergerac. Murders.
Of, Bergerac. Yeah, okay.
Ooh,
murders,
like yeah. Only Murders in the Building. I love that one.
I love that one. Yeah, we love that one. We're not probably not as funny as that. It's probably more Midsummer Murders.
Well,
we can aspire to it, but that makes you the young.
The young beautiful woman
the
again.
The young beautiful woman dealing with the two doddery old men in the block of flats.
Yep.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's
that
sorted.
Me.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. I'm a psychotherapist specialising in trauma, and I find it very relaxing to listen to. Even though from your exit interviews on your other podcast, I'm sure a career in politics is very traumatic. I particularly enjoy listening to Peter's dulcet tones. He's adorable. And I always look forward to Polly's optimism. I've got real questions about Joe, to be honest. And Danny believing that nothing moves the needle apart from maybe focus groups. My question, finally, we're there. Joe says, my question is, does negative campaigning really work? And obviously, in the last week or so, we've had some great examples of this, thanks to the brilliant brains of the Tory propaganda machine. This is the Conservative video about London.
London, a city steeped in history. But tonight, its ancient streets bear witness to a different tale. A tale not of kings and queens, but of crime and desperation.
There we are. There's two problems. Well, there's two issues with this advert. It is very negative. It also used some footage of New York in it, which they've had to take out. On the broader question, Danny, or maybe on that video specifically, does negative campaigning work?
Well, actually, it's quite a good illustration of when it does and does not work. So one of the things the Conservative Party faces at the moment is a very strong narrative against it. And in those circumstances, they have to perceive that people are not laughing with them. They're laughing at them. And this means that if you make a video which you think is amusing, as I doubtless they doubtless did with that pastiche, they assumed that people would laugh, and they didn't for two reasons. One is it wasn't really that funny, but secondly, people aren't in a mood to laugh with them. And so that kind of humorous take on negative campaigning was never going to work for that reason. Beyond that, though, negative campaigning also relies on a positive base. People have to sort of feel, okay, I'm willing to accept to take it from you. You are basically making a better the devil you know argument. And you make the better the devil you know argument, you've got to be a better devil than the people you're trying to make look terrible. So there's no point, for example, having a big campaign against on the other side's spending plans if your own spending plans don't stand up to scrutiny. And not only that, but people feel that. So the answer is negative campaigning, I think it does work. That is, you can try to build a negative narrative. As you know, I think it works within the context of the importance of campaigning, which I think people tend to overestimate, but it does have some. It can have some impact, and I think that negative people are basically loss averse. So negative campaigning works better than positive campaigning, even though everyone says I hate negative campaigning, because people are much more concerned about things that they lose than they gain. So yes, it does work, but you've got to do it off a positive base, and you also got to be very careful you use humour. In all circumstances, it's got to be funny, and often it isn't, and this wasn't. But also, people have got to be laughing not just at all, but also with you.
I think voters are in a permanent state of suspension between hope and fear. And you obviously, as a party, want to give people hope about the future and what you can do to improve their lives and deliver for the country, and to feed their anxieties about the alternative, you know, make them fearful of change. So all that, this is just, you know, basic campaigning. You might strike a balance, sort of 60-40 or 80-20, you know, negative and positive. But it all goes on. But here's the point about negative campaigning. It only works if it actually feeds fears that voters already have. I mean, latent fears which are then brought to the surface about the party you're attacking. Now, in the 1980s, this was turned into a sort of highly professionalised art form. It started in the United States under Reagan and then was transferred across the Atlantic from the Republican Party to the Conservatives. And Saatchi and Mrs. Thatcher really turned it into a brilliant, not an art, it was a science. Mind you, the Labour Party in the 1980s was giving them quite a lot to attack. And so you had a sort of almost a relentless, emotionally driven tide of anti-tax, anti-government, anti-crime, anti-communists, anti-the enemy within. You name it, you could drive public opinion against it and lump it in with your opponents. I remember going to the United States in 1988 to look at the presidential campaign of George Bush one, and Michael Dukakis. And Bush one brought out the most extraordinary attack ad, which destroyed Dukakis. I mean, I was standing there, just a man sort of almost sort of dematerialized in front of your eyes, and it was about crime. George Bush one was for the death penalty. He was tough on crime, tough on, you know, first degree murders. Michael Dukakis, in contrast, was a liberal, a bit softer, and one of the things he advocated was weekend prison passes for murderers. Okay? Now, you'd have thought, arguably, it's a very nice, objectively sort of sensible, nice, liberal, rehabilitating, you know, policy for first-degree murderers. The problem was that one of these murderers, Willie Horton, if you remember this famous attack ad, came out of prison, met a couple, stabbed, raped them differently each over a period of an entire weekend, and the attack ad, which lasted only for about 30 seconds, pinned the entire responsibility and blame for Willie Horton and what he did on Michael Dukakis. It was crushing. And I think that British politics, well, it's never gone to that extreme thank goodness. And I think people in Britain would probably recoil from it if it was taken to that sort of height of menace as they did in the United States. But it did work. It destroyed Michael Dukakis.
It's clear that, you know, as Danny says, people say they don't like negative campaigning, but it can work. But the problem is that it does sort of eat away at enthusiasm for politics and politicians and enthusiasm for people to put themselves forward for public office. That sense that, you know, being criticised for the policy choices you've made is one thing, you know, and if you want to go into public life, you expect to be held to account for the things that you've done. But there are times when this becomes, I think, profoundly harmful to a sense that there are standards of behaviour in public life. And, you know, we've seen recently quite a lot of attack ads by the Conservatives against Keir Starmer because, for example, when he was a barrister, he took on cases under the cab rank rule of, like, I don't know, ostensibly bad guys. But that's what you're supposed to do, because if you have rule of law and a system of justice, somebody's got to be the barrister for the bad guys. Yeah. And we saw there was controversy when Boris Johnson attacked Keir Starmer around his supposed role with Jimmy Savile, which led to some key members of his staff resigning in sort of horror that he would sort of stoop that low. I mean, and at the completely trivial end of the scale, you know, the one time I stood for election, which was, I think, 2004, in Lambeth Council, there was, you know, another Lib Dem candidate who had been accused, and I don't remember anything of the substance of, like, whether anything was ever found against her, but accused essentially of having sort of done the forms wrong for right to buy, basically. And so therefore that was drummed up as had stolen a council house, and it was just the Lib Dem candidate, and it was distributed all over the borough, including in the ward where I was standing. And I then discovered that when I went canvassing, people would accuse me directly on the doorstep of having stolen a council house. And and absolutely put me off. It's a lie, right? I've not stolen a council house. But it's also that sense that there's no honour or integrity about the way you behave to people who might profoundly disagree with you on policy substance, but have just as much a right to put themselves forward for public office as you do. And I think that those of us who want to be involved in politics have to sometimes think it might work in the short term, but what does it do to democracy for me to behave in that way?
Because ultimately, particularly in a local council election, you know, the points of disagreement are, should we have weekly or fortnightly bin collections? You know, how much money should we spend on local council services? That should be what you're arguing about, and not doing the dirty on a candidate. And which then that actually then does the dirty on every candidate.
And my experience is totally trivial and completely nothing to do with the scale of attacks that we have seen on, you know, major figures in our political life. But, you know, you think about, again, I disagree with her on all sorts of stuff, but, like, the attacks that you see against Diane Abbott are that monstrous, actually. Sure. There's things that that she has done that we will all disagree with. There's things that, but turning it into a campaign that gets into the worst of us as humans, the worst of us as voters, that it can work, but we shouldn't do it. Sometimes you should aim
higher. The reason
why
it's important is because the bedrock of politics is trust.
Yeah.
You know, belief in what somebody or a party or a politician will do for you and your family for the country. Trust that you can take at face value what they're saying, that they really are sincerely determined to do it and to carry it through. And if the parties and different politicians are taking negative lumps out of each other the entire time, what you're doing is not just destroying trust of one in another, it's trust in anyone. You can't trust any of these people, and that's when the whole thing begins to disintegrate.
That's true, but people do it because it works, it is destructive in that way. But people are very loss averse. That's the critical thing about it, and therefore raising something that you might lose out of electing person X is better than, more potent than what they'll gain by voting for
but
you.
You're talking about something like explaining what you might lose because you'll have to pay more taxes, or that, you know, the streets might be less safe. That seems to me to be reasonable. It might be negative, but reasonable. Go back to the AV referendum, where, you know, deciding whether we should change the voting system. The No to AV campaign, first of all, they did attack ads that said that, with pictures of babies in incubators, saying that those babies would die if we had this different voting system
with
because
boredom,
it's more expensive.
Possibly,
but... No, because the incubators would be turned off because there wouldn't be enough
cash. There
wouldn't
be enough money, yeah. And so they worked out how much introducing the system was going to be and then divided that by the cost of an incubator and then came up with a number for how many incubators we would not have.
That strikes me as still grounded in policy rather than personality, but nonetheless grotesque.
Yes, obviously.
And they also put leaflets. I remember having two separate ones, these No to AV leaflets, explained that Nick Clegg had betrayed the country by putting David Cameron into office. Now, that is a reasonable belief to have. But I know for certain that it was the Conservative Party and the donors to the Conservative Party who had put the money together to put forward these leaflets, to put forward an attack message based on the idea that putting their guy into office was betraying the nation. And when you do that, you are just destroying the basic foundation of what politics relies on.
Can I just investigate this for a second? So I think we can all agree that absurd and untrue comments can be both unpleasant and outrageous. But the question is whether they're worse, if they're negative ones than positive ones, right? Which is the contention you're making. So I want to just question that for a second. So I happen to think that it's bad to make untrue statements or tendentious statements or wild accusations, speculative accusations, because it's wrong to make tendentious and wild statements. But I happen to also think that it is legitimate to point out the flaws in or dangers of electing your opponent. And if you ask me, why am I involved in politics? One of them is to prevent things, to prevent extremism, for example, that I disapprove of. Right. So it is effectively a negative reason. So are you suggesting, Polly, that there's something about negative campaigning that means that the wild and speculative things are particularly bad? Or is it just really that you dislike untrue and wild statements?
I do dislike untrue and wild statements. But what troubles me is the visceral personal attacks on individuals that seem to me almost designed to drive them out of public life and to question the legitimacy of their existence.
Polly, most of these visceral, nasty, vicious personal attacks do not come from your political opponents. They come from the media. They come from tabloid newspapers. And then they, in time, as they accumulate and the dam bursts and they get taken up by the broadcasters who think they've got to... You know, it's really... I mean, in the 1990s, when there was just endless weak... in week out sort of scandal sleaze with the Tories, Tony Blair said, absolutely untouchable by us, we will not go anywhere near this. Well, he didn't need to go anywhere near it because the press were doing it for us. We got towards the 97 election and we were pursuing about 40% of our campaigning was attacking, negative, you might say, pointing out the flaws, deficiencies of the Conservatives, the record of the government and what they were proposing to do. And it was heavy pounding, quite effective by us. I remember about 9 months before the election, Blair comes to me and says, I'm not really happy about this. I would like us to stop all the negative attacks. I just want us to be completely positive. And I said, you know, fine, thank you very much, Rob.
I'll bear that in mind.
Bear that in mind. And then he came back and said, look, you know, I've really been thinking about this quite deeply, and I actually do think we shouldn't do this anymore. And I said, well, look, fine, but I'm afraid, you know, a campaign has to have a balance, it has to have a lot of ingredients, and it also has to have momentum. and attack against your opponents does give you momentum. In the end, he said, look, attacking this government is like clubbing a dumb animal. And I think it's going to start reflecting badly on us. I don't think you need to do it anymore. You know, everyone can see the animal sort of dumb and half sort of dead. They're doing all these things to themselves. The media are revealing one thing after another. I think we should be absolutely hopeful and positive. And actually, we did change the campaign from sort of 60-40 to 80-20.
Well, I would, the only thing I would point out is you did later mock up William Hague with Margaret Thatcher's hair and flying pigs with Michael Howard's face on it. It wasn't
Yeah, because
all...
they were so funny and we wanted to cheer people up.
very good. Right, but you mentioned the papers. But
those were later campaigns for which I was
okay,
not directly.
Of course not. Yeah. Newspapers do one thing and adverts, which parties can control, do another. This is a voice note. We've had him from James.
Hi, guys. This is James in London and I love your podcast. This is an election year and the Tory media, as in the Mail, Telegraph, GB News, are going all out attacking the Labour Party. But is their right-leaning readership, viewership only interested in voting either Tory or Reform? So will their impact on Labour be pretty much less than zero?
I don't think the Telegraph and the Mail have a huge influence on Labour voting. Quite honestly, because I don't think they have a vast number of Labour voters reading their newspapers. I think they play a very big part in the internal politics of the Conservative Party. I think they sort of turn different wings and factions and groups and aspirants against each other, and they cause a lot of mischief. But the reason why the newspapers and their endorsement of parties is less important is because the whole newspaper industry is less important than it used to be. There's such a proliferation of different sorts of media now, all generating their own different forms of influence. And actually, I think the broadcasters pay less attention to where the newspapers are leaning. But there will be a very interesting question come the election later this year, if it's not in January, Bonnie, over where the Sun goes, because the Sun is still the most significant single newspaper in the country. Like it or loathe it, that's what it is. And their endorsement of Labour, of New Labour and Blair in 1997 was, in my view, very influential. So here's the question. Given that the Sun, you know, doesn't like to fly in the face of its own readers and would prefer to sort of follow and go in the direction that their voters want, and given that the pollster Sir John Curtis is saying now it's, what, a 99% chance of Labour winning, which success will involve an enormous number of Sun voters voting Labour if it's true, what does the Sun do in those circumstances? Does it sort of continue to lean right, as its preference might be, because it doesn't really trust Labour fully? Or does it say, no, the country's got to change, we need a new government, but, you know, if it's Starmer, OK, we'll continue to hold his feet to the fire.
So, first of all, obviously, there's also a Labour press as well as a Tory press, and I think that's quite...
Where's the Labour press?
Well, The Guardian, for example, is Labour press, and so is The Mirror. And there's a reason for raising that, because does The Guardian have an influence on the Tories, right? It's just the same way of looking at the question that was asked about the Tories and Labour. And the answer is yes, because sometimes it publishes extraordinary scoops that have caused, for example, the Parsi story.
The answer
to your question is, I don't think it makes much difference to the Parsis, even at Westminster. Let's leave aside the question of how important campaigning is at all. When a newspaper merely publishes an attack or an op-ed, which is an opinion column on politics, is in the Tory press, I don't think that'll have much difference on Labour. But if an important story is broken by those papers who are looking for stories to kind of antagonise the people their readers don't like, because in the case of the Mail, for example, there's still a very heavy Tory readership, then that can have an influence, because it will then cause a story that, you know, Labour has to cope with for days. So I think In the end, as Peter's just pointed out, newspapers are they represent their readers, and they don't have a free choice. You know, the Times didn't, for example, have a totally free choice about which position it took on the European referendum. I think our readers would have found supporting Brexit an odd position for the paper, given who our readers are.
The Sunday Times bat leave, and the Sun bat leave.
The Sun did, you know,
While all being part of the same organisation.
Absolutely. The Sunday Times, I thought, was unusual in the sense that I felt that its readers almost certainly didn't, and the paper did. But it's not usual for those papers to buck what their readers think. The interesting thing about the Sun, I think, you know, some of the tension with the Sun is just caused by the fact that the leader of the Labour Party was director of public prosecutions and tried to put various of the Sun journalists and executives in jail. And I suspect that may influence them, whereas otherwise these natural forces might kick in.
It would, though, even we allow for the fact that fewer newspapers are sold and everyone's more promiscuous and reading news from a whole load of sources rather than laying out the printed newspaper on the breakfast table. Were the Sun to back Keir Starmer at some point in the run-up to the election, that becomes a news story, doesn't it, rather than a moderately interesting leader column.
Yeah, I don't think anyone reads leader columns, no. Do they? Really? But so,
I mean, obviously, I this.
You read
the Western Daily Mail.
I do. You know, obviously, for the benefit of the tape, I do read all of the Times' leaders every day.
Of course, you yeah. do. Of course, it's in your job contract. But it is one of these sort of ecosystem stories. But even though that doesn't necessarily mean it's kind of reaching millions of people who go, oh, yes, I shall vote Labour because the Sun says so. And I absolutely must follow what it says on whatever, you know, this is not how people behave. But the impact it can have in the ecosystem is important. It can give people a sense of confidence and ambition. It could send the Conservatives into even more of a sort of flat spin. And that then has these sort of ripple effects. And of course, part of the reason the Sun might pick Labour is because they don't like to back losers. And I think lots of voters are a bit like that as well. You know, a sort of strong horse view. Like you want to be on the side of the winners. And so the more this kind of starts to crystallise a sense of momentum, the more weird it will feel for lots of individual swing voters to, you want to stick with the guys who are on the way out? Like, why? Why not sort of pre-book yourself a slot on the winning team and just go with the flow?
And actually, I suppose the knock on it also depends when it happens. So I remember with the referendum, the EU referendum, the Times didn't take a view until a day or two before, I think, because it actually, we were very under very strict instructions that we reported the campaign and what the claims were and were they right, and nobody, reporters could say publicly, couldn't go on TV and radio shows to say what they were backing because we wanted to report it properly, and then they took a view at the end. Whereas if 6 weeks out from an election, the Sun or the Daily Mail decides we're going to back Labour, as well as that being an interesting thing in itself, it does mean you don't then get 6 weeks of buckets of you-know-what being tipped all over you.
That's true. But it also,
In terms of the news out, it's far more important about the news output that you don't have day after day after day stories kicking Keir Starmer.
Yeah, but it also gives you what is the single most important feature, an asset in any election campaign, and that is momentum. Small M momentum.
Big M momentum is very different.
Peter, what evidence is there that actually exists?
Momentum?
Yes.
Because if you
Newtonian physics.
If you have, as you have done, fought in a campaign, you know what it does to your morale. You know it gives you a sort of lift. You know it puts wind into your sails.
You know it's psychological, though. So what is momentum?
Yes, I think it does, because it affects your performance, and more people, you know, see a party and its leadership being talked up, talked favourably, more people sort of moving across the ledger, moving in its direction.
So I can see the bandwagon.
And before you know where you are. Now, I think in the case of momentum, you either have it or you've lost it. There's no middle way. You either got momentum with you and giving you power and force in what you're doing, or it's just flowing away from you. And that is so important.
Can I just ask that? The reason why I ask that question is that I'm not sure there's that much evidence to suggest. Let's take, for example, the famous Clegg Mania thing. You would say that was momentum. Suddenly momentum was in with the Liberal Democrats, and it just didn't register on polling day at all.
Well, so it might have been even worse for the Liberal Democrats had there not been that momentum.
If momentum, well, that's possible. That's a possible
hypothesis. It's also possible that the, what did you call it, buckets of...
Unpleasantness.
Unpleasantness. That were tipped out. You know, he was accused of being a Nazi sympathiser on the front pages of the newspapers. Okay. He was accused of having embezzled money from the party to fuel his personal lifestyle. I mean, like, absolutely made up.
And he also
trash.
He stole that council house too. But the
come on, that's my council house.
For legal reasons, Nick Clegg, as far as we know, has not stolen the council
exactly.
house.
But I'm just saying, I don't know that there is actually an accelerating impact of a poll during an election that you could measure. While you would anticipate, social psychology would lead you to say, if you know, you're more likely to support somebody if somebody else does, and therefore, you know, and during the last election, for example, definitely in the red wall seats, people looked round to their neighbour and discovered people were going to vote Conservative for the first time, so they felt they had permission to see it. So you would anticipate. So it makes a kind of sense that there would be this momentum. It's, the reason I ask the question is, I just don't see it.
But I think that. I hope some pollsters will write it and tell me whether this is true or not. But
maybe in a form of a poem.
In the form of a, but I think that when you ask people who they voted for last time, several years ago, they often misremember, and there is some evidence to suggest they're more likely to remember that they voted for the winning party. I feel like I've read that in an election study in the past, but it's
definitely
possible that I made it up.
No, that's definitely right.
So that's sort of
great.
Sort of,
Danny says it must
that's
be
sort
true.
Of reverse momentum.
Well, no, exactly.
It's like, a sort of a coalescing
because
effect,
people want to feel associated with the winner.
Yes.
And you can therefore hypothesise that would have some impact in the run-up
to
polling day.
So actually,
as well.
You know, it's the Labour Party. You know, you get the Sun one week, and then you get the 100 businessmen, and that's happening. And then you get some show. We've talked about celebrities, some show busy, but that sort of sense of, well, everyone's getting on the bandwagon.
Well, it's why people in by-elections in particular, people really want those stake boards up. You know, the big sort of estate agent size style signs saying. Because it, you didn't get the vibe that, oh, this is a place where everyone's voting Conservative. Yeah. And what you want is for that momentum to be enough that maybe some of the other people can't be bothered to turn up to vote at all because they think that they'll lose.
Well, that was a great question. Thank you for that, James. And also thank you to Stefan, to Joe and to Rowan for your excellent poem. If you want to send us some questions, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. You can send us a voice note, 0333 003 2353. We'll be back same time next week. That was How to Win Election with Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkelstein and me, Matt Chorley.